I'm Bob Franklin. You're listening to the Public Affairs Program, Like It Is. Bill Denby has an inspirational story you will want to hear. Today's classic edition of Like It Is features the story of an extraordinary man.
To get Bill Denby's story, we go to him via telephone in Howard County, Maryland. Thank you, Mr. Denby, for joining me today on Like It Is.
Thank you, Bob.
In 1971, you lost both of your legs when the truck you were driving was hit by a rocket in Vietnam.
Yes, that's correct.
Take us back to that moment after the truck was hit and tell us what was going through your mind.
Well, at that time, I thought of a couple things. One was my mother, and I thought, you know, she's always told me, Billy, you're always in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I thought of her in that instance. The second thing I thought of was the game of basketball, knowing that my left leg had already been completely severed, and the right one was messed up so bad that it had to be amputated later on, I found out, that I would not be able to play the game of basketball anymore, and that was devastating.
You spent a year rehabilitating in Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C., and shortly afterwards, you returned home.
Yes.
What were your plans and your expectations, and how exactly did you feel about going home?
Well, I was very happy to go home. I had no plans. The only plans I had was to just try to get through life as it was, and that was seemed to be very difficult at the time. When you're 19 and you lose your legs, I guess at any age, but it was real devastating for me at the age of 19 because I'm seeing all the things that people are doing my age, and I cannot do those anymore. And particularly playing the game of basketball because that was the one sport that I loved so much.
Mentally, this had to be tough on you mentally. Tell us mentally what type of effect did it have on you?
Well, it devastated me mentally because, again, I couldn't do the things that normal people do. And with that, it just sort of, that's what controlled my whole life in the sense of starting to feel sorry for myself, getting involved with the drugs because no one really cared, or at least that's what I was thinking. And so, you know, when people don't care and you don't care about things, including yourself, then, you know, I just started feeling sorry for myself and went down a wrong avenue. And so, you know, eventually you have to come back to reality.
Was it basketball that actually brought you back to reality?
It was sports. I think it was first drag racing and then getting into skiing and wheelchair basketball is what brought me back. But there was also people that were there to sort of help me along. One was my family and my mother in particularly, and a friend of mine who is now living in Detroit. His name is Kenny Winchester.
You have called the disabled the new minority group on the block.
Yes.
Why this designation?
Well, I think it is because, you know, with all the other minority groups, blacks, Hispanics, women, and so on, we're the group that is just finally being looked at as a resource, a resource that could give something to this nation. And we're just sort of looked over. And that's why I seem to use that phrase that we're the new minority group on the block. Now, with all the things that are happening, all our capabilities, we're still looked over as far as job, housing, things that are very important to everyone in this country. And, you know, we're just sort of passed by.
President Bush is expected to sign into law the Americans with Disabilities Act. Personally, how do you feel about this law?
I'm very happy that we have it because it's going to make changes in private industries for people like myself. What I'm disappointed about, and it does just not apply to this new ADA bill, but all the bills that's helping minorities. You know, if we didn't have to have this prejudice towards the minorities, then we wouldn't need a Bill of Rights. And for those people who do the discrimination, you know, if they would just stop and think about what if it was me, what would I want? You know, we're saying that, you know, we're only asking that you hire qualified people. At least that's what I say when I speak to people, and not so much because the government says you have to have X amount of women, X amount of blacks, X amount of Hispanics. Let's go out and hire qualified people, and though there are qualified people in those groups, including the disabled. And so that's what I try to pass on to people. It's not that we're looking for a handout. We're looking for a chance.
Explain some of the myths generally associated with disabled individuals.
There are myths if you associate that you can catch what we have, you know, so that's also a problem. That's a problem that comes in our personal lives and dating. I think there are a lot of myths about the negative words, handicap and crippled and things of that sort, that sort of set seeds in people's mind and perpetuate what those myths are about, that we're not able to do anything. Well, if we're looking back 30 years ago, when having a disabled kid or child is the same as having your 15 or 16-year-old daughter get pregnant during those times, it was something that was just forbidden. And therefore, you have must done something wrong. And therefore, you usually ship them off to an aunt and uncle 50 states away. Or, you know, you hide them in the house there that no one knows that you your daughter's been pregnant or that you have a disabled kid. And it's those kind of myths that has gone up through the years. And, you know, the rumors have been passed on through generation to generation. Now, my aunt, she's no longer with us now, but she had said to me as a child, don't play on those crutches or one day you would be on them. Well, I guess if she was living today, she would probably say, see, Billy, I told you not to play on those crutches. Well, those are the kind of things that that makes it very difficult for people like myself.
You have a national audience here. Tell us how we should correct that.
I first think you need to, as far as the language is concerned, is to focus on the positive. Because I think when you use the word handicap, the word cripple, and other negative words, I think it sets a seed in the child's mind, whether they're disabled or not, that he is not to do. And that's not what we want. We want something positive. We want something uplifting. And it's going to push this kid to go beyond his and anyone else's expectations. You know, I also like to think that socially, that, you know, you need to get to know someone before you make that decision whether they are capable or not, whether they're worth knowing. And that's the unfortunate part, because a lot of times within a split second, and this just doesn't include the disabled, but anyone, whether you're going to associate or not, you know, whether you're a person who like dark-skinned people or real dark-skinned people or light-skinned people or women with red hair or women with brown hair or blonde hair, you know, if they don't have those things that you particularly are interested in, then right away you've cut yourself off to them. And that's the way it is with the disabled. You see a disabled person, you right away make a decision, oh, well, I'm not to associate. And with that, you've lost a friend, perhaps, or something, someone that could make a major difference in your life. And so what I'm asking people is, again, give us a chance, not only in the business world, but socially. Whenever you see a disabled person, most of us, because most of you are very curious on what happened to us, you know, we're ready to answer those questions. But realize that we also have a schedule and that we have to stay on that schedule as closely as possible, just like you do. So if you find someone who said, and, you know, it's like when I walk down the airport and someone recognizes me from the DuPont commercial. You know, I'm running to catch a plane. And this gentleman walked up and said, and I turned, and he sort of startled me at first. And he said, no, I don't want to get in your space, but I saw you. I told my wife, I just have to tell you what the wonderful work that you're doing and keep it up. And I said, well, I'm sorry I can't talk with you now, but, you know, I'm late I'm running late to catch my plane, and he understood that. So I want people to be understanding that we are capable. It's just that, again, we need the chance to prove it.
Have you experienced firsthand or have been told by others firsthand of some of these experiences regarding the myths that you just mentioned?
Well, I've experienced it. When I first got back maybe a year or two after I returned from Vietnam and out of the hospital, I went to apply for a job, and the minute I told him that I was disabled, I could see the expression change on his face, and of course I didn't get the job. Now, I thought I was very qualified for the position at the time, and you know, so that's what's working on people's mind. If I can interject something, you know, my involvement with DuPont has been one, I think, been a very happy one and very successful. One of the things that I noticed, and that was some information they had given me, that they did a study to find out if there's a difference between a disabled worker and their normal worker. And they found out that actually there was no difference, because there are myths about, that the disabled person will be losing a lot of time because of their disability, that they are a hazard to themselves and to their coworkers, and a number of other things that came up in the report. Well, it found out that none of these were true. In fact, that the disabled worker was, they could count on them a lot more than they could their able-bodied workers. So as you can see, that we are capable, but again, we have to constantly prove ourselves. Just like when I go out and speak, one of the first questions is asked to me, do you really play basketball? Or is this just Hollywood, you know, that you don't really play? And I say, yes, I do. And usually someone will challenge me, and I usually have to go out and play. Well, you know, that's what we have to do as the disabled community, is that we constantly have to prove ourselves. We have to be 10 times better than the average able-bodied person. Because, you know, again, so much more, you know, we're not expected to do, but in order for us to finally get in, that we have to prove ourselves to be much, much smarter, more eager, probably overwork ourselves in a sense of getting in and continue to prove us so we can hold that job.
I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. My guest today is Bill Denby, an extraordinary individual. Now, you hold several national amputee records in the shot put, discus, and javelin.
Yes, I do.
What role has athletics played in your total rehabilitation?
It has played a major part. What I did in high school, I never drank or used drugs. And once I made the decision that I needed to clean myself up, I took myself back to that age, and I slowly got myself off the drugs without going to a rehab. Well, something that I don't recommend for everybody today, but, you know, without that sports, without that, I guess sports, really what it did was build that self-confidence, knowing that I could go out and compete and win. And so with that, it just sort of spread over into every part of every facet of my life. So sports was very important.
Now, you're scheduled to travel to Moscow for the Peace Marathon?
Yes, I am.
Are you looking forward to that?
Yes, I am. I was sort of called late and asked to be a part of this. In fact, I was asked last year, but my schedule just didn't allow it because I was doing a lot of traveling. I'm looking forward to it. Apparently, the Soviet troops, soldiers, had the same problem that the Vietnam guys had when we returned to our country, and of course, their country did not accept them going off to fight in the Afghan war. And so we thought, not me, but the Vietnam Vets of California thought it would be nice to not only do this peace marathon, but also take them some of the technology that we have here and try to teach them while they're over there. I'm only spending 7 days there because my schedule, again, only allows me to do that. But I think the whole group is spending something like 20 days or 21 days there.
I'd like to ask you about your thoughts on two very prestigious awards. The first, the Presidential Victory Award presented to you at the White House in 1989, and the Maryland's Athletic DAV Outstanding Disabled Veteran for 1990. Tell us a little bit about those awards and what they mean to you.
Well, they're very prestigious awards dealing with the disabled community, and to be honored to receive one is one real special in my heart. It's something that I'll never forget, and I think the Victory Awards will show that. I was sort of asked to say a few words, and probably one of the first time in my life I couldn't find any, at least for a while there. The DAV Award is one also very special, very prestigious. You know, I guess in so that you understand is that what I've accomplished over the years of my life, the last 10 or 15 years, particularly my story, I guess you don't start out by going, well, if I do this, then I'll get this award, and I'll maybe perhaps do this. You know, I did these things because I needed a change, and perhaps if I didn't change, I would not be here talking to you today. I'm happy that someone has recognized me as being someone that is very strong, and hopefully someone for the young kids, whether disabled or not, can look up and say, you know, well, Bill did it. Maybe I can rethink my values and do it too. So, you know, I guess this is a thank you. I see it as being a thank you, and one that is very special. And, you know, with all the awards that I've received so far, these are going to be real special in my life. When you can touch someone's life, and I really, truly believe that I'm doing that, this is a thank you. It's a thank you for all those days that you're traveling 6 days a week, being away from your own family, having your own family understand that, you know, this is something that you have to do, that it's, you know, very important in your life. And so I've been really blessed. I've been blessed to receive the awards. More important, I've been blessed to have a family that understands that, you know, this is a need, and I need to fulfill that.
Many Americans have seen you in the 1987 commercial playing basketball on the Seattle Foot, which was developed by Dr. Ernest Burgess. In that 30-second spot, it's amazing to hear your story and watch you go one-on-one. Tell us about how DuPont became interested in casting you for this commercial, and what effect has the commercial had on your life?
Well, I'm not so sure if DuPont was just looking for Bill Denby. I think they were looking for anyone that could play basketball and use the Seattle Foot. They happened to find me along with other guys down in Tennessee playing basketball along with some track events that I was doing, and I just felt a real privilege to be able to do this. It's changed my life in the sense that I'm never home anymore, but more important, I hope that it's changed the life of the whole disabled community. I hope that doing the DuPont commercial, it has set a standard for the disabled community, a standard in the sense of not just for the disabled, but also for the able-bodied individuals here who continue to think that we're not capable. Now, we're very capable. And again, it goes back to giving that chance to us to prove it. I've been given that chance. I also think that it was very privileged for me to have that opportunity, because there are so many things that go on in the world today that people don't get a chance to do. And so I feel very privileged.
You are truly an inspiration to all of us, but who or what has been your greatest inspiration?
I think there were I'd have to say three or four people in my life. One, my family, again, particularly my mom, my wife and my daughter, and a couple guys who played a big role in my life. Kenny Winchester, particularly. He was the guy that sort of turned me around, took me under his arm. Joe Henson and Paul McDowell are in there, too, who was always there for me and gave me some guidance when I needed the most.
What is the lesson that should be taken or learned from the Bill Denby story?
I think the lesson to be learned or taken from this is that if you want something bad enough, you can succeed in doing it. Which is real simple to say, but real difficult to do. It was not easy for me to come from out of the gutter and be where I am today, but I did it, and I did it because I wanted something different. My mother wanted something different. People who knew me, I guess to explain that is, I was honored in my hometown, and there were a lot of people that I haven't seen in about 25 years, including teachers, that was asked to come in and speak. And I kept hearing these words that waiting to be challenged. And, you know, today I think we have a lot of kids who are Bill Denby, waiting to be challenged. And somehow, some way, we have to go out and challenge these young people, or else we're losing them. We're going to lose them. And so my job is to do that. You know, that's my mission in life. And I have to thank the Pond for at least allowing me to do that through their sponsorship. You know, going into their plant sites, their communities, and talking to the young people in high school or from K to 12th grade. And so when I tell them my story, I hope that there is something in there that they can grab onto and hold on to it and help them to pull them up and move them on. Again, we need to do something. We're losing too many people, young people, through drugs and alcohol, through dropout and pregnancies. You know, you got to do something. I think what I'm doing is what I was meant to do in life, to affect someone else's life. And again, I know I'm doing that. I know I'm doing that when I go into a place and I see what their facial expressions are when I walk in and when I walk out that afternoon. Or if I remember one young man down in Texas who was 10 years old when I first met him and they asked me to speak. Well, he's lost his both legs in a fire, and some relative's sister and cousins were killed in that fire. And then again, he had 40% of his body still had burns on it. And as I was talking to him, I noticed that he was looking out the window. And when I walked out of his room about 30 minutes later, I said to the agent that was traveling with me, I said, I think this one I've lost. Well, I had the chance to go back last year and see him. And his grandmother, who came to me and said, you have inspired my grandson to do better. I've never got so tired of hearing Bill Denby's name as Bill Denby does this, I'm going to do it too. Bill Denby's does that, I'm going to do it too. And, you know, I thought I'd really lost it, but he heard the words that I was trying to say to him. So that's when I know I've made a difference. And for that one and the thousand that I probably will never hear those words come back to me, but I know that I'm making a difference. And so that's been my mission in life, is to continue to do that.
Speaking to many audiences, what's the most frequently asked question of you?
How did I get involved with this? Have I been a public speaker before? Do the legs hurt? Those are the kind of things that I hear from a lot of audience. They're very curious about Bill Denby. Does the foot really does what it says it's supposed to do? And I tell them yes, but what it comes down to is the one person who wears it. If they had the courage to go out and do these things and fall on their faces and able to laugh at themselves and pick themselves up and go on, then they're going to be a great success.
I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.